Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Death in Ice Valley is returning.
We've been trying to find answers to an unsolved mystery.
And now we're back with an update on the case.
We'll be here to tell you more about it at the end of this podcast.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Claire McDonnell, and in the early hours of Friday, the 28th of June, these are our main stories. President Trump has said he will seek a delay to the census due to take place in 2020 after the Supreme Court blocked his administration from adding a question about US citizenship. Small island nations have accused oil-producing countries of trying to erase the science on global warming at UN climate talks. Twitter has said in future it will label tweets by politicians that break its rules on abuse, harassment and incitement to violence, but will leave them online in the public interest. Also in this podcast...
This was the right decision. However, I think there's also a lot of questions about whether the welfare of the animals has been protected in every way that it can be.
Russia begins freeing captive whales from what has been described as a whale prison after public outcry. President Trump says he is seeking a possible delay to the 2020 US census after the Supreme Court blocked his administration from asking if respondents were a citizen of the US or not. He tweeted that he had asked lawyers if they could delay the census, saying it was ridiculous that the government and country could not ask for this information. I spoke to the BBC's Nada Tawfiq in New York.
The Trump administration said it wanted to enforce the Voting Rights Act that was passed in 1965 to protect minority voters. But recent evidence uncovered from a Republican strategist's computer suggested that the real motivation was basically to help Republicans redraw voting districts, trying to cost Democratic-leaning regions with high immigrant and Latino populations seats in the House, because basically the census is used to determine how many seats each state get in the U.S. House of Representatives and how federal dollars are distributed. So the Supreme Court heard how the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross actually tried to convince the Justice Department to request the citizenship question and really hid his true motives.
So what happens now practically? Will the census be printed without the question?
Well, as part of the ruling, the court basically sent the issue back to the Commerce Department to decide how it wants to proceed. Originally, the deadline for when a decision had to be made by the Supreme Court so the question could be added or not to the census form before they're sent out was the end of the month. But now we've had a tweet from President Trump saying that he thinks it's totally ridiculous that our government cannot ask a basic question of citizenship. And so he says he's going to talk to lawyers to see if the census can be delayed no matter how long until the Supreme Court can rehear this issue. So everything's a bit up in the air.
And you mentioned the Supreme Court. They are conservative-dominated courts. So how much of a surprise was this that they went against the Trump administration's wishes?
This was a big surprise. For the reason you mentioned, but also because it seemed like the court was leaning toward the fact that the government had the right to reinstate the question. It was really only the fact that the Chief Justice John Roberts sided with the liberal minority because he said the rationale for including the question wasn't accurate, and the court was presented with an explanation that was incompatible with what the record revealed about the agency's priorities and decision-making process.
Nada Tawfiq talking to me from New York. In recent days, El Salvador's government has warned people against risking their lives to reach the United States after a man and his baby daughter drowned in the Rio Grande. Photos of their bodies found face down in shallow water with the 23-month-old girl's arm around her father's neck have sparked condemnation. Commenting on the photos, the US President Donald Trump said, "I hate it." This comes as the US and Mexico implement tougher policies to stem the flow of undocumented migrants. Most of them are from Central America. The photographer who captured that image of father and daughter was Julia Leduc, who works for a Mexican newspaper called Jornada. She spoke to BBC Mundo, the BBC Spanish language service, Her words have been voiced over because of the quality of the telephone line.
What's been happening around here near the new bridge is that there have been red alerts for the conditions in which the Central Americans, the Africans and the Cubans were living in. Deplorable conditions without any official help. There have been groups of citizens who have been organising to provide water to them because they are people who arrive with nothing after having crossed the whole of Mexico. We've been reporting that they've had nowhere to sleep in the camps, no toilets. They've been washing in the river. The kids have been washed in buckets with water from the river. This has been going on for months, but no one was doing anything. Now people will see what is happening in Matamoros. There's been a crisis for months. I'm hoping with this photo someone will do something and we don't have to continue taking photos of drowned migrants in the river. That's what is now news and has gone viral. It's converted into a call for more consciousness to the governments so they understand that the migrants are still coming and that they're dying on the frontier because no one is paying any attention. It was Sunday afternoon when the police reported that there was a woman screaming on the bank of the Rio Bravo and she was in a terrible state. When the police and we arrived, the young girl told us what had happened to her family. The police started a search, but it was suspended when night fell, and because it's a dangerous area where there are animals. Then they started searching again on Tuesday, and they found the bodies at around 10 a.m. Those of us who were there, journalists and police, were surprised that the bodies came out of the water together and embraced. There are other families with children in the camps who are waiting for their chance to present their request for asylum. And there are families who are desperate, who are in terrible conditions of extreme temperatures, that are hungry, thirsty, sleeping outside in inhumane conditions. They are not criminals. They are migrants in transit.
The photographer Juliana Leduc. At UN-sponsored climate talks in the German city of Bonn, there have been tensions between oil-producing countries such as Saudi Arabia and small island states. At issue is a key scientific report about the impact of rising temperatures, which recommends huge emissions cuts. The BBC's Matt McGrath is at the conference in Bonn.
You may remember the launch of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report last year in October. It was a report about what would happen to the world if temperatures went up by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius this century. It said two things, basically. Yes, it was possible to keep global temperatures under 1.5, but it would take huge effort, massive emission cuts over the next 10 or 12 years. And that report really became the focus of, I suppose, global focus on climate change, where you saw young people taking to the streets, you've seen countries like the UK sign up for net zero targets for 2050. But here in the UN, here in this conference here in Bonn, there's been a lot of opposition, there's been a lot of division between countries. The richer oil-producing countries and fossil fuel producers like Saudi Arabia and the US have been very against the report and bringing it in, whereas smaller countries, small island states, have been very positive about bringing it in. Earlier, I spoke to Ambassador Lois Young from Belize, who's the chair of the Alliance of Small Island States, and she told me why getting this report, why that science was so important to her.
Our bid for a higher ambition is the science. The science underpins why we are asking countries to increase their national plans to cut down on their emission levels. Without the science, we'd be begging for charity. So science is at the root of everything that we stand for. And it's been established. We asked for this special report. And now we see this move at the negotiations to try and have it almost erased from existence, which is impossible to do. But there's this move to pretend as though it's not there, not to refer to it in documents. And it's been ongoing since we got here.
How do you feel about the countries, including Saudi Arabia, that are leading that push to erase the document, as you say?
Well, the countries that are trying to downplay the importance of the document, erase it from the records, not all of them are showing their faces. It's hard to know sometimes who is playing what game. It's unreal. It's as though they're resigning our area, our AOC states, to collateral damage. I mean, it's like we have no importance. It doesn't matter. But this is actually the defining report, because this is the one that sets the goal at 1.5 degrees, and this is the one we want to rely on.
The countries that are opposed to this are pushing against having the science here. They're all major fossil fuel producers. Do you see this as them ganging up on the smaller islands, the smaller states that don't have the economic clout that they do?
Lip service is paid to our plight. Everyone gets up there and says, oh yes, we need to increase ambition, we need to do this. But in reality, when it gets right down to the brass tacks and it involves dollars, it's a different tune. This is important. It affects all of us, rich nations, poor nations. We're all going to have to deal with it at some point in time. And those countries who are resisting the science, I'm very sure that in their own countries, they're preparing for climate change. They just simply want to get a head start on the smaller countries.
Belize's ambassador to the UN, Lois Young, speaking to Matt McGrath. Tunisia is widely seen as the success story of the Arab uprisings that swept the region at the start of this decade. It has become a democracy, but one that has its share of troubles. On Thursday, there were two suicide bomb attacks on security forces in the capital, Tunis. One police officer died. The Islamic State group has said that it carried out the attacks. Separately, the country's 92-year-old president was rushed to hospital after suffering what officials have called a severe health crisis. Chris Stephen reports on North Africa for the Guardian newspaper. He was until recently based in Tunis. Tim Franks asked him what he made of the recent bomb attacks.
Well, they were, very worrying from a security point of view, because they were two separate suicide bombs right in the downtown area, and really the worst bombing in about 3 or 4 years. And I think that the concern for officials is that IS seems to have built up its capacity, which they thought they'd got rid of, to launch these kind of attacks. So a lot of people are going to be thinking, you know, where are they going to hit next? And you remember that the Bardo thing was in summer of 2015. Well, the British Foreign Office only last year said, OK, it's now safe for tourists to go back. So again, security forces are going to be thinking, well, how were they able to build these bombs and have the capacity to do it? And what's next?
And clearly no country wants to have IS attacks at all. Tunisia is particularly dependent on tourist income.
Yeah, it's very much the Achilles heel, and that was the problem with the attacks last time, that it nearly broke the tourism industry. And again, that creates social unrest and economic problems. But as you said, it is the one success story of the Arab Spring. There is still a functioning democracy. That the president's ill, we hear, but you have a functioning parliament. And I suppose it will endure even through this. But economically, yeah, it's a big question.
And in terms of the president, I mean, he's 92 years old. We've, I think, yet to discover in what way he is ill. But how much does his health determine the way in which the democracy functions in Tunisia? How key a figure is he?
Well, I think, yeah, people will say this is continuity. I mean, this is a president who entered politics in 1941. He was a legal advisor when they broke with French rule in 1956. He's been in and out of different administrations ever since. He's been in the political realm ever since Tunisia's been an independent country. And he formed this party, Nida Tunis, that won the parliamentary elections. He became the president. So certainly from his supporters' point of view, this is continuity. He's pushing liberal values for women's rights and so on. I suppose his supporters would say, well, you know, we need this guy to keep the progress of democracy continuing.
But, I mean, for all those hopes to be vested in a 92-year-old, are there other politicians who could, if needs be, take over?
I think so, yeah. But I think the problem's going to be who's going to take the reins. That one of the reasons why he's still in power is because you have a lot of people below him sort of scrapping for position. And if, you know, if the king becomes incapacitated, then does it set off a power grab?
Chris Stephen there from The Guardian newspaper. Twitter is to introduce new rules for the tweets of politicians and other important sources that it says will strike a better balance between free speech and accountability. Its plans would label and deprioritize tweets from verified politicians if they break Twitter's rules. Steve Jackson has this report.
Twitter has been facing growing criticism for allowing some politicians to break its rules on abuse, harassment and incitement. In the past, it has refused to remove such tweets, including some from President Trump, arguing that they were newsworthy. But it has now decided on a new approach. It will apply to politicians and government officials with more than 100,000 followers. If their tweets breach the rules, they will be labelled, and users will get a warning telling them to click on a link to view the tweet. While this may help to tackle one problem, it could also expose the company to claims that it's stifling free speech.
Steve Jackson with that report. Still to come in this podcast.
People are, I think, wondering about what the state of her health is.
Despite concerns, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel's office has insisted she is well after having a second shaking incident in as many weeks. The Albanian president, Ilir Mita, has ordered the postponement of this weekend's municipal elections until October, prompting a rebuke from the Prime Minister, Edi Rama. President Mita said he consulted party leaders and ambassadors from the European Union. Guy Delaunay reports.
The conflict between Albania's head of government and head of state is heating up an already febrile atmosphere. Opposition parties have been absent from parliament and staging anti-government protests for months. Their boycott of the local elections prompted the presidential postponement of the poll. The Prime Minister has pushed back, refusing to recognise the postponement and starting proceedings to impeach Mr. Mehta. Undeterred, the president has now rescheduled the election for October, even though the government and electoral authorities insist the polls will be open this Sunday. Meanwhile, opposition activists say they'll take action to stop the vote taking place.
Guy Delaunay with that report. The G20 summit begins later today in the Japanese city of Osaka. A major focus of the gathering of the world's 20 most industrialised nations will be the outcome of a meeting between President Trump and the Chinese President Xi on Saturday. But also on the agenda is climate change. From Osaka, the BBC's diplomatic correspondent James Robbins sent this report.
Listen to the Oba-chan, ladies of a certain age, out on the streets of Osaka, singing and dancing. This week, they've been renamed the G20 Grannies, and they're promising laughter and happiness. So it's a shame the summit here in Osaka is most unlikely to be harmonious, positive, or uplifting. Global divisions on several huge issues are simply too deep. Monsoon rains have been falling for hours and hours here. None of the arriving G20 leaders could stay entirely dry. Rough justice, maybe, because conflicting responses to climate change will be all too evident again. It's broadly Donald Trump versus the rest. He's leaning on Japan to drop any reference to reducing the use of fossil fuels from this G20's agreed conclusions. That's simply too much for Emmanuel Macron, President of France. He's urging Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to hold the line.
Si on ne va pas plus loin sur notre ambition climatique,
if we don't go far enough with our climate ambitions, then we're holding the summit for nothing. Prime Minister Abe and I care about the G20. We're fighting to have an ambitious text.
Et donc nous nous battrons pour avoir un texte ambitieux.
But Donald Trump is fighting on other fronts too, notably trade. He'll go head-to-head here with China's President Xi over their escalating tariff war. It's really hurting the world economy. There's been plenty of trouble at global summits before, of course, particularly in this Trump era. But now Japan's Foreign Minister Taro Kono seems to speak for many leaders, worrying that the entire international order is at risk.
We really need to work together to sustain this liberal international order that has sustained economic growth and the peace after the World War II.
Listen out in the next few days for prime ministers and presidents speaking up here in Osaka for the G20, for the entire interlocking architecture of global financial and political institutions.
James Robbins in Osaka. Now, as we heard in the earlier podcast, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel's office has insisted she is well after she was seen shaking on Thursday at an official event for the second time in as many weeks. Standing with her arms folded, she trembled as she listened to a speech in Berlin by President Frank-Walter Steinmeier. Mrs. Merkel was handed a glass of water but rejected it. She had blamed the previous incident on dehydration. Markus Becker is a European correspondent of the German magazine Der Spiegel. Chloe Tilly asked how the German press is reporting this incident.
Actually, the reporting has been quite intensive. And I think the main reason is obviously that it was the second time for her to have such an incident in a very short period. So people are, I think, wondering about what the state of her health is.
And are people speculating, or are they accepting that we're being told, well, actually, Chancellor Merkel will be able to travel to her next engagement and there's nothing to worry about?
Well, of course, people are speculating. Then there have been some, I have to say, very nasty attacks from the far right, from the AfD, basically along the lines that, you know, someone who disadvantages her own people so badly has to get some scars herself. And then there have been a lot of media reports along the usual lines, you know, attempts to find doctors who dare to do some diagnosis from far away. And well, then of course it's there are speculations about in how far she still will be able to keep up the appearance that she is virtually indestructible.
And that is the thing, isn't it? She's renowned for these incredibly long, whether it's at the European Union or these long negotiations where she will stay up through the night and has always been viewed as somebody who is incredibly strong. Now, clearly, this isn't showing a weakness in her, but it's not how people have seen her portrayed previously.
Yeah, that's exactly it's exactly true. You know, I've seen her after a number of EU summits, even very, very long ones. And almost always she has made the impression to be much, you know, fresher than all the journalists present, even though she had hard, difficult negotiations throughout the night. But during the last couple of summits, people noticed that things became a little different, that the rings under her eyes were a little deeper. She made the impression that she was more tired than she used to be. And this is not only my impression. This is what many colleagues told me afterwards, that, you know, she left the room and everybody was, you know, basically people are looking at each other and we're asking themselves, well, is it only me, or do you also have the impression that she looks very tired?
Markus Becker from Der Spiegel magazine. Finally, last week, the Russian President Vladimir Putin used his annual phone-in broadcast to announce a prisoner release with a difference. The captives were whales rather than humans, detained in the Russian Far East in what has been called a whale prison. They had been destined for sale abroad, but the practice has now been banned. It's estimated that there have been nearly 100 whales and orcas kept at the facility. And on Thursday, 6 beluga and 2 killer whales were released into their natural habitat, the Sea of Okhotsk. Tim Franks spoke to Charles Vinnick. He is the executive director of the Whale Sanctuary Project.
I'm certainly pleased. This was the right decision. However, I think there's also a lot of questions about whether the welfare of the animals has been protected in every way that it can be. The animals have spent almost 7 days in transport boxes over very rough roads, and upon arrival then, they were immediately released into the open ocean. And the recommendations of the scientific working group appointed by the Russian government, as well as our own team, that they be held in sea pens in order to work their muscles, in order to reduce the lactic acid that builds up in the muscles when you're not moving them over that period of time, and to give them adequate food and hydration prior to release.
And if that sort of thing doesn't happen, what could befall the whales?
You're compromising their chances of success. And equally concerning, the belugas and the orcas were released in the same area a few hours apart. And because these are marine mammal-eating orca, belugas are potentially prey animals for them. So releasing them right near each other is not an appropriate approach.
Did you have particular concerns about the place that they were being kept?
keep in mind that this is 97 animals. So this was one of the largest, if not the largest, capture ever. And so the animals were in very confined spaces. Moreover, it was very cold during the winter in that area, and the animals had evidence of frostbite. These were not optimal conditions. And orca and beluga, they're very sentient beings. They're used to living with their families in the case of orcas, and this didn't happen for these.
What do you make of the fact that Russia has decided to ban the sale of whales overseas and to say that the whales that it has kept in this facility are all going to be released? I mean, broadly, you must be pleased.
The decision that they announced to change the law and close the loophole about capturing cetaceans for cultural and educational purposes, and therefore for sale to marine parks, is leadership on behalf of the Russian government that the whole world should be applauding.
Charles Vinnick there from the Whale Sanctuary Project. And that is all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can. Just send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Claire McDonnell, and until next time, goodbye.
Death in Ice Valley is back.
She's laying with her head down there.
Fake passports, the wigs, the unprescripted glasses.
There are somebody living who knows more about this case.
I'm Marja Tigroff.
And I'm Neil McCarthy.
And we've been trying to find answers to an unsolved mystery.
Why all this secrecy?
It was like a cover-up.
Now, 1 year on, we're back with an update on the case.
Yes, with new leads to follow from you, our listeners.
This is maybe the first lead of evidence we have in almost 48 years.
More on the original investigation.
They were being told, don't work it anymore, or don't go into that.
And maybe even a brand new eyewitness.
I feel I met his lady. That's a special episode of Death in Ice Valley, recorded live in Bergen in Norway from the BBC World Service and NRK.
Catch up with the whole series now, and you'll also find our new episode.
Just search for Death in Ice Valley, wherever you get your podcasts.